This podcast is supported by Understood Explains. As parents, we are often having to figure out things as we go, and that is very true for our children's education. And to help you out, I want to tell you about a podcast called Understood Explains. This season is hosted by teacher and special education expert Uliana Ortube, and she discusses all the things you'd want to know about individual education plans, or IEPs, what they are, why they're needed, who benefits from them, and what to expect when you have meetings with teachers. I could have really used this podcast when my son had an IEP for speech when he was six. I was overwhelmed trying to understand the process and what everything meant. The episode on Understood Explains, Does My Child Need an IEP, was the kind of info that would have really helped me get the most out of the educational support of the IEP for my son. And if you need that kind of support, I really recommend this podcast. To listen to Understood Explains, search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. Welcome to Mom and Mind. I'm perinatal psychologist and host Dr. Kat. There is more to the story than just postpartum depression. This podcast aims to share it all, from personal stories and lived experience to experts who break down the ups and downs of life from getting pregnant, pregnancy, perinatal loss, and postpartum adjustment to new parenthood. While this is not psychotherapy or medical advice, it is all of the stuff you ever wanted to know about mental health and new parenthood. Hey there, welcome to Mom and Mind. I'm your host, Dr. Kat. In our episode today, we are going to be talking about parental mental health and specifically factoring in fathers. Our guest, Jane Honickman, is the founder of Postpartum Support International. And since then, she has gone on to co-found Postpartum Education for Parents, co-founded the Postpartum Action Institute, and written several books, Community Support for New Families, I'm Listening, A Guide to Supporting Postpartum Families, My Diary, A Postpartum Journey from Pain to Purpose, Postpartum Action Manual, How to Provide Comfort, Encouragement, and Guidance to New Families, and her latest, Parental Mental Health Factoring in Fathers, co-written with Dr. Danny Singley. Jane was born and raised in Palo Alto, California, and has lived in Santa Barbara since 1970. She has come a long way since she had her first child. She and her husband have three adult married children, eight grandchildren, and a cat. You'll be able to hear from Jane how passionate she is about making sure that we are including all persons in the family system, and very especially bringing fathers and their needs to the forefront. You can find Jane's book, Parental Mental Health, Factoring in Fathers, on Amazon or on their website, factoringinfathers.com. And on their social media, at Parental Health, on both Instagram and Twitter, they are constantly sharing bits and pieces from the book, as well as a free infographic that they have on their website that you can download and share with your providers, share with your partners to let them know what father's mental health needs are during the perinatal time. So let's dig in and talk with Jane. Welcome, Jane. I'm thrilled to have you with us.
Hi, Kat. Good morning. It's lovely to be with you.
I am really excited to talk with you because you really do bring the full arc of all of the movement in perinatal and parental mental health, beginning in maternal mental health and PSI. So you have such a depth of knowledge and experience, and I'd love to hear a little bit more and have the listeners hear a little bit more about how your path started.
Oh, it's a pleasure to sort of rewind my brain and talk about the past. I love to do that. It really all begins with always wanting to be a mother and wanting to be just like my mother, who was my role model during the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And very traditional, except that she was a feminist, and I was raised with the awareness that men and women should be equal, but they weren't, certainly not during those early years. So I was set up for going to college during the 60s and really being impacted by social change. There was so much going on in America, around the world, but particularly for me, on the streets where I grew up and in the college I attended. And I was, you know, sensitive to what was going on in terms of inequities and needing to make things better. But that fit into my fantasy still of wanting to marry and have babies and stay at home and do all of that good stuff. Well, in the 60s, I met my to-be husband. The summer before, I went overseas and to be a student in Denmark. And what happened is that we did the big no-no in those days. The social acceptance of pregnancy before marriage was absolutely verboten. So when I went off to Denmark, I was actually pregnant. And then, of course, I had to relinquish the baby for adoption. And my whole life turned upside down. But I was in a state of what's called denial, and the ignorance around the whole thing was profound. And, of course, I did end up coming back. My boyfriend and I did get married, and we went the route of the traditional buying the house and having the job and trying to get pregnant again and all of this. And we did. But then it's like, what fantasies do to you is just set you up for disaster, especially when somebody like myself who's had some kind of a trauma like that and is in complete denial. I mean, they never talked about it. It was so forbidden topic. And I played along that this our son was born in 72, our first born 66, and then we had another daughter in 75. The environment was one of which I'm very proud to say that I participated in my community with my friends through an organization that sort of made all the difference to me in terms of my career. And it, again, my mother had been a member of American Association of University Women. And I paused to tell everybody about AAUW because it had such an impact on my life and my whole career and what you've seen come out of, you know, over the years with my work is really because of them. And my friends and I started postpartum education for parents in the 1970s. And this is when we were all young parents. And notice I'm going to say the word parents because we were all feminists and we did not want to just be known as mothers. In fact, we used to say, I'm not just a mother. You know, I'm a parent. And I, you know, the movement was have the fathers in the birth room delivery. They need to see us in labor. They need to be equals with us. And so you can see that that was sort of the setting the stage for what evolved for me. It's never been just about women. It's never been about just mothers. It can't be because we know that there was a sperm that got us pregnant.
Right.
And we felt rather strongly about the fact that there was this change was happening. And again, it was all happening around so many other things. Yes, childbirth education and breastfeeding and the learning about our bodies. We had no clue. And during this time, we were really rabble-rousers, and we just asked a lot of questions, and we wanted to shake it up, and we did. But starting PEP, which is what I did in the 70s with my friends, set me up for an unknown trajectory. But it was always about adjusting to parenthood and not recognizing that there could be such a medical emergency aspect to this until we got so much publicity, and I was getting the taking the phone calls and doing the interviews with people who are journalists, and one thing led to another, and I was suddenly on the platform with psychiatric illness, and it's like, what? What happened? I don't know. How did this happen? But I was all about learning and taking a day at a time and loving it, again, promoting the idea of peer support, because none of us who started PEP had any background in the medical field, the psychological field, not anything like that. In fact, my background is the opposite. I'm a sociology major. So I always saw this as community should get together. We can be better and stronger if we can do this together and share our experiences. So that really molded me. And AAUW gave us the money. We had a grant to start PEP.
Oh.
And then I got a grant as an individual to study what was going on in the field of postpartum education for parents around the United States. And that was the basis of my then realizing, oh, this is about families. And there's a national movement called the Family Resource Coalition in the 80s. And then I met the founders of Marseille Society. And in 1984, I was invited to talk about PEP as a community response, a system of action, it was called. At their first meeting, and it was like throwing me into the fire den. I had no idea what I was doing, who these wonderful people were, and they came from all around the world. It was held in California, so it was easy for me to get to, and my eyes were just so big. And I was pretty much groomed to start seeing the world of parenting in another light. And because it's scientifically generated, or the scientists were the ones who were moving us forward, I fell into trying to understand what this history of mental illness really was all about. And on a personal note, my father was bipolar. And that on top of the fact that there was a lot of mental illness in the other members of the family, and my own trauma is like, oh gosh, golly,
right?
Whoa, what's going on?
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow, so that's a fast learning. I mean, it's an interesting way to kind of be introduced to and learn about all of this. And, you know, even the organizations that you talked about, PEP and Marseille, are still going strong to this day. They're still out there. Lots of programs come and go, but it's really amazing that your foundational work with PEP, starting PEP, and then hooking up with Marseille, and then that starting Postpartum Support International is just amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's not so much amazing. It's just about persistence and understanding that can't be about one individual. It has to be about forming networks and communities and learning about boards and nonprofits and moving forward that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating stuff, and it's the stuff I like to do. I'm not a clinician. I think that's an advantage. I am a lived experience. That's an advantage. I'm also love to learn, but I also am very curious. I'm kind of obnoxious. I mean, I would show up at these meetings and they'd say, what are you doing here, Jane? Why are you back? It's like,
good for you.
I'm not going away.
I love that. Good. That's great. And that is what it takes, I think, you know, for people who are passionate about something, you know, trying to convince other people that they, you know, that your passion is equally important, and that you need to be there, and that you should be there, and that, oh, by the way, they should be passionate about it too.
That's moving forward. Enough. I would say the other word is patience. Persistence and patience, because nothing happens overnight. A lot of people just get discouraged and do give up, unless it's your livelihood. And that's a different piece of this whole movement that I didn't realize was happening. But Dr. Hamilton, who was my guru, who said to tell me what I should do, he was impressed by what I brought to the table, which is the consumer peer support, social support component. But he always knew that we needed to train the clinicians and educate the medical field. And that simply was his priority. And he felt the best way to do it was to get people like me bugging other people, bugging the professionals. And that's exactly right. So he did that. And I always was sort of aware that he was doing all of this. And I was very close to him because he was a father figure. He was my father had passed away, and Dr. Hamilton came in as this role model father connection for me. And it's like he even played tennis like my dad did, and it was sort of looked like him, and then all those sort of things. So there was a personal connection as well. And he lived to age 90 and died when we were really on a roll and doing extremely well with PSI and the Marseille Society, of course. Oh, it's a debt of gratitude to him. And they do. They acknowledge.
Oh, for sure.
So I sort of got off track here. But this is a time, though, when you can truly say that it became all about the mother. But when I look back at all of the Marseille Society meetings I attended, and then when we started PSI conferences, I absolutely felt it was imperative to have the father's research presented. And when I pull out the syllabus from the 1984 conference, there was a paper presented actually by an Italian who had done the work on CUVAD, which everybody needs to learn about CUVAD and the syndrome which males during pregnancy of their partner, wife, the mother of their child, also has symptoms. And it is ancient, and people have noticed this. Anthropology has documented it all. And I find it fascinating, and that the men suffer too. And that was something I was like, okay, we mustn't forget the men.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests, too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket, telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.
And it's in your work, and as you've added more and more to your sort of resume of programs and books and whatnot, that has continued to be a part of your work, is about right. Families and the system, and not just focusing on women or birthing or the mother.
That's right. And yet I can tell you that as a very strong woman, I am proud to see, like AAUW and the other organizations I belong to that have empowered women, mm-hmm. Literally since trying to get the vote and before, that we've been very successful finally. And I'm mm-hmm. all about that. However, the irony is that we are now, I believe, doing to men what we complained about they were doing to us during the 60s and then the 70s.
Yeah,
There's been a flip. And yes, there's inequities still, and there's horrible abuse and all sorts of things that we know we need to talk about. All the Me Too movement has done very well with doing that. However, men are humans, and men mm-hmm. have feelings too. And I live with a man, 50 plus years we've been married. I raised one son. I welcomed two sons-in-law into our fold. I have grandsons. I care about men. Mm-hmm. And I care about their feelings and how we as women step on them. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we were complaining about as women. I'm old enough to tell you that we had to use our husbands' names in the paper. It was, if you had your picture of the paper in Santa Barbara, it had to say Mrs. Terrence Honickman.
Oh, wow.
It couldn't be Jane Honickman. And we had to fight for that.
Grief,
you know.
Right.
So now we don't do that.
Right.
But I hear from the men that, in fact, my niece has just gotten pregnant. And when I spoke to her mom, the soon-to-be grandma, I said, how's it going? And has Theo been involved? Well, he wasn't allowed into the ultrasound room.
What?
Said, what do you mean he wasn't allowed in? Mm-hmm. That's not true.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then I just learned, did you know that men's names are not required to be on birth certificates?
Oh, I hadn't learned of that.
Apparently,
I wonder what the history of that is.
One state in the United States requires it. I need to dig into this because I don't know. I just heard this on a lecture that we still view men as not important in regards to their role as father. And that's one of the reasons there's not enough research. One of the reasons that men are not participating in the research on paternal mental health because
right.
you can't find the men. You can't find the men because they're not listed. Their names are not.
Oh, I see what you're saying. That is so interesting. I really am interested in looking into that and the reasons why. I'm sure there's a valid reason in there, but there's a lot of implications for family history and being able to track people down.
There's no excuse because there's an egg and a sperm. They both need to be identified.
Uh-huh.
And I'm also, because of my experience with adoption, you need to know who you come from. You
mm-hmm.
need to know
mm-hmm.
your father and your mother
mm-hmm.
and your grandparents on both sides. It's just absolutely critical as a human being to
okay.
know where you come from in order for you to go forward. So I'm very passionate about that.
Yeah.
So there's discrimination going on against the men that women are not aware of.
Mm-hmm. That is fascinating. And so are you hearing a lot? Well, in your the book that you've recently written, Parental Mental Health Factoring in Fathers, is, you know, really driving home all of these points that you're bringing up. What are the things that you're seeing and that you want to make sure that people know that is happening with fathers or that we should be changing?
Everything.
Okay.
And it begins by having conversations with men. Mm-hmm. And I was always on the lookout, as you can guess, because of my personality, for the right man to collaborate with. I needed to find somebody who could write this book, because I am not a man. I cannot write about what it's like to be a father.
Mm-hmm.
So to find that gentleman, kept my eyes and ears open. And sure enough, I was at a meeting and I saw this little note saying, we're looking for fathers to participate in research on relationships with their infants. I thought, aha, who's this man? And so we fondly call it stalking. I tracked him down and I dialed in and we had this chat and we hit it off. And his name's Daniel Singley.
Yes.
So Dan Singley is a clinical psychologist and a researcher and a father, and he focuses on men's excellence. And that's his shtick.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Dan, we need to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
So he rolled his eyes at me. And he's like, well, I don't know. I said, well, I'll take care of all of it. It's going to be under part of my other books, handle all that. But I'm not qualified. But what I am wanting to do is express my point of view with explaining about PEP, explaining about how we saw this as a family issue, new families and parenthood and parents, and that everybody has experiences, everyone has feelings, everybody has hormones. That's the other really powerful thing. Remember, as women, we always focus on our biological systems because they're so obvious. Men, not so much. And that's kind of been their downfall, because we don't acknowledge that they have, mood swings. They definitely have reactions, and they have a brain, and it runs, they have an endocrine system.
Mm-hmm.
All of that's in the book. And it's a little tiny book. It's an easy book to pick up and put down. And we get feedback from the readers saying, I thought that, or gee, I didn't know that, or aha, I should have done that.
Right.
I should know that. And it starts with what I find the most important piece that I learned from Dan is what it means to be a man. And understanding masculinity and our attitudes and biases about what does that mean? What does masculinity mean?
Yeah.
As women, we don't take the time to figure that out.
No.
When was the last time that came up in conversation? Not recently. And that's the core of the book, is to start understanding that. And Dan lays it out very nicely. And this whole field of paternal mental health is around understanding these shifts from men today generally had no role models at all. I mean,
right.
I started this conversation by saying, my mom is my role model. This is who I wanted to be like.
Mm-hmm.
Men today struggle, and they call it precarious manhood. I mean, precarious fatherhood, but precarious because you're not sure where I'm fitting in with all this.
Right.
Society says, oh, like I did with my husband, you're going to be in the delivery room. You're going to see what you did to me, and you're going to see this baby come out, and he's going to be your baby too.
Right.
And you're going to change diapers.
Mm-hmm.
We have those expectations as women to make this an equal partnership, unless you're in a culture where you actactually put down the man.
Mm-hmm.
And there are parts of the world where we have the other way around, that men want nothing to do with this process, and that's their cultural prerogative, and that's the place. But if we're as women in America saying, in the Western part of the world, saying, no, the men need to be involved too, well, we need to be a little more open about having conversations with, what does that mean?
Right. What does that look like? Right. So it's specifically if the generation before them, their own fathers weren't really, but potentially weren't as involved as we are thinking they can be or wanting them to be, that they're learning a new skill set as they go, because the previous generation wasn't as involved. And that was, I think, expected to some extent, that they would just be out of the room, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's really fascinating too. And I can see the shift within in my own life. And what you're saying is, you know, after my son was born, I had a lot of realizations about how deeply emotional boys are and men are, and how my own societal kind of upbringing about, you know, what men are and who men are supposed to be. It was so much edited and so much smaller to what their actual range is and capacity is. And I thought, gosh, I don't ever want to tell my son that he can't have feelings or that he's supposed to, you know, man up or whatever, because that cuts him off from his full experience.
Amen. That's exactly right. And my dear son, who's now a father of three and nearly 50 years old, says, you know, he owes it to me that whether right or wrong, he's a feminist growing up. I mean, he's
great.
He's such a nurturer. One day after school, I probably fourth grade or so, he came in and they said to me, "Mom, if I ever get divorced, I want the children." I guess, "Stephen, where did that come from?" Well, clearly there's his peers are having divorces happening in this class. And I don't know where his little brain went, but that, you know, he was always wanted to be, you know, father, and always wanted to be the nurturer, and he is.
Yeah.
So, you know, and my brothers were. Our father was not, but my brothers are amazingly interacting. Mm-hmm. And again, times have changed, but we have to have those conversations. And when do we fit that into, let's have a baby, let's conceive, now we're pregnant, here's the delivery, uh-oh, now what? So when do we get the opportunity to have conversations about all this?
You just insert them like we are now into the you know, dialogue. It's super important. And to your point, I think that supporting father's role in the transition into parenthood is also not just about fathers. It's about the parents. It's about the system. And when everyone is taken care of, then everybody fares better.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that it doesn't matter who raises a child, no gender. And that's the other thing. We need to be more inclusive of all the, what does it look like to be a parent?
Wow.
We all do it the same way. We may not doing it exactly in the same way, but we are conveying the same love and nurturing, and that's what's important.
Mm-hmm.
But women are guilty. I certainly learned this from a pep group way back in the 1970s when a father in our group said, when he was trying to do the diaper and he was being criticized, he felt it. He spoke up. How do you expect me to do it? How can I learn if you don't leave me alone and let me do it my way?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I hear that a lot.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh, for sure. It's hard because, I, you know, sometimes it's coming from a place of anxiety for, let's say, talking about a male-female relationship. Sometimes it's some of the anxiety of the postpartum mom kind of being so highly worried about anybody else taking care of their child.
Right.
But there is something in there about either assuming that men don't know what they're doing or they're going to do it wrong or something along those lines that that does, you know, seep into the relationship sometimes.
It really does. And we it's about being mindful, of course, about all of these things, but it's so, and maybe slower. I mean, not done doing it your way. It doesn't mean it's wrong way. But I wanted to transition a little bit into what are the signs of depression in men and anxiety in men. We know that the rates are the same, approximately. Certainly the same 10%. I was taught by Dr. Hamilton and all of the Marseille Society way, way back that it's 10% for women. And now we know from the research it's 10% for men. And it fluctuates, of course, and it has to do with intensity, the degree of the experience and the suffering, and then, of course, onset.
Mm-hmm.
And for men, we know that it's delayed for the men, and we also know that the greatest risk factor for a man is if his partner, is the mother of the baby, has been depressed. so we know all that. But it takes a different form, and we need to listen to what does it look like for a man to have postpartum depression and the anxiety and the behaviors that come out of that. And we know that the anger, irritability is much more pronounced for the man. And we also need to, that wreaks havoc, of course, on marriages. And that's the other thing that we have, and or partnerships, that, again, we don't have time. It would be so lovely during pregnancy, don't you think? We don't have the baby right there in front of us, outside the body, that we can start doing some of this conversation. Yeah. And I think that putting that into our daily routines, you know, okay, try to talk about this, and then the baby's screaming all the time, and or not. Whatever it is, who looks after the new father? There's no doctor for the new father.
Right.
But there's a doctor for the family, and that's a pediatrician. And if you haven't met and heard David Levine, who's the pediatrician who finally came out, so to speak, about his depression post-birth of his son, it's been 7 years ago or so, he really has nailed it. He's done so much to finally get that lived experience out in the open.
Right.
And he's more believed because he's a pediatrician, a professional who, as he says, I should know. Well, I didn't know in myself. So that's been important.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. There is no specific doctor for the father. And I wish that it were more prevalent with pediatricians to be looking in on the family. But, you know, we have some serious blind spots in our medical system and difficulty with siloed care that, you know, pediatricians are just for the baby, but, you know, in so many ways. So, yeah, I agree with you. There should be a broader reach and broader perspective in any profession that interacts with a perineal family, not to be checking on the whole system. Yeah. Have you seen anything that indicates we're moving in that direction?
Oh, we definitely are. We definitely are, because there are people like Dan Singley, Jane Honickman, David Levine, and a wonderful researcher, Sheehan Fisher, who is at a PSI meeting, he's been at several PSI conferences speaking about his research. You know, there's a whole group, there's a cadre of wonderful researchers. But back to silos, I mean, they're the psychiatrists, and they're they're the psychologists, they're the clinicians, and there's simply not enough men in the field.
That's really true.
And we really, you know, the big thing is we've got to be screening men and women. And so this whole mandate thing, I'm anti-mandating, because it makes it sound like it's only going to be the woman who should be screened. It's not true. And a screen in itself is so limited. And David Levine likes to quote what Jane Honickman said to him when we first met. I'd forgotten this. And he said, no, Jane, you said people lie.
And that's right. For sure. Yep.
And so we have to have conversations again. And it's about being comfortable. Well, the obstetrician generally has not had behavioral health training. Psychiatrist doesn't know, have this opportunity to get into the wellness piece around developing families until there's an illness. So we've got a really mixed up system unless we start talking during pregnancy. And I think during pregnancy, there's an opportunity to, you know, we call it education, but and people are want to know, but wouldn't it be wonderful if we had many more parent discussion groups going on during pregnancy? That's an opportunity that I don't think we're taking advantage of.
No, absolutely.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tiny humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.
Hey there, I'm Debbie Reber, the founder of Tilt Parenting and the author of the book Differently Wired. The mission of Tilt is to change the way neurodivergence, whether that's having a learning disability, having ADHD, being gifted, autistic, or some combination of all of the above, is perceived and experienced so differently wired kids and the parents like us raising them can truly thrive. On the Tilt Parenting podcast, I get to talk with authors, therapists, educators, and parenting experts who are committed to this mission. I ask the questions my listeners are most curious about when it comes to supporting our kids. And in turn, my guests share strategies for challenges, out-of-the-box ideas for navigating school, best practices for therapies, tips for advocating, and so many thoughtful insights on what it really takes to help our kids grow up feeling seen and respected so they can create awesome lives for themselves. I know that raising a differently wired kid can feel overwhelming and isolating, but I promise you, you are not alone, and it can feel so much better. If you're on this parenting journey, come listen to Tilt Parenting. Together, we can shift this paradigm and show up for our exceptional kids with hope, possibility, and joy.
I have been struggling with this. What I think happens for a lot of people is that they, I don't know, there's kind of an assumption that things will be fine or that they don't need, I don't know, certain kinds of support or education before the baby comes. And then afterwards, when there's an issue, they're, you know, they feel a lot like, well, it would have been nice to know, or I wish I had known, or, you know, I didn't know. And I have not yet figured out how to bridge that gap to convince people that having the education ahead of time, even if it doesn't happen to you, is preventative and exactly. Supportive. So
based on Dan's and my book, we have developed a very simple little brochure that lists out the significant things that dads need to know and ask themselves. And it's available online for free. It can be downloaded at Parental Mental Health. And it's on our Facebook page, Parental Mental Health, Factoring in Fathers. These things are out there. We just need to get them out.
Right.
We've written it, but we have to get it out. I've also developed a training that is available. It's a 4-hour in-depth interactive system of learning that's based on the book, based on all that I've learned from Dan, and gives people a time to actually think and have activities. It's not lecture-based.
Yeah. So that's what people need, action.
Yeah. And I'd love to be able to get the word out that that's available through me. And I did it, it's been piloted once in April in a virtual setting because of the pandemic still, but I would love to be invited to travel and again that we can get to people's communities and just say, look, hey, let's just sit down and have this. It can be done in an hour, but not as well as 4 hours.
Right.
Something like that, and certainly just engage in your own community.
Sit down with
the men. I mean, and the other thing is the problem we have faced all along, and it started when I started PEP, is when we need to be referred to a professional, where are they? Who are they?
Mm-hmm.
And we've done, PSI is fabulous in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you look and count up the gender gap between how many are men and how many are women, and who are seeing whom, where, we're not doing well at all.
Absolutely.
So we need... In the venue of, because of pandemic and all this happened with mental health finally getting onto the front page, the lack of male therapists, and particularly those of color, is glaring.
Mm-hmm.
And we, again, it's a pretty simple kind of thing. It doesn't take a whole lot of training, but it does take an awareness first to start finding individuals who are willing to expand and say, no, I want to see expectant couples. I want to focus on the father.
I want to factor him in.
So things like that. I think we could, you know, zip it up really fast if we just turned around and said, okay, I'm a therapist, and I need to realize that I'm seeing the women, but who's seeing the fathers?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you 1,000% that even if you're just meeting once, that's better than nothing. If you, you know, therapists out there who are meeting with someone who's pregnant, bring the father into the session, even if it's virtual, even if it's just to talk about like, oh, things are going to shift and change and how is everyone's needs going to be taken care of. It's absolutely essential. And it supports it supports birth, it supports postpartum for everybody when you can have those conversations.
It absolutely. And one of the things that's in our book, and I had not heard of this organization, American Pregnancy Association. Are you aware that there's a group called American Pregnancy Association?
They have
put out an expectant couples list of checkoff points for the men. It's wonderful.
That's really great.
And so it's in the book. You can find it, download it, their association. Mm-hmm. But it's under, you know, the realization that dads suffer too. They really need support. Mm-hmm. And they needed support. And what we do now is we need the father to support the mother. And that's the wrong message, 100%, because it's not wrong. That's true. But he has been neglected. He is, and as the movement saying, the forgotten parent is mm-hmm. the father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely true. I really hope that people can hear these points that you're driving home, because it is, I think in some way there was such a fight and an effort to make sure that birthing person's needs are met, which is great. And so we're at a point where I think that's happening more and more, but it does also do a disservice to the whole system if everyone involved isn't taken care of. And especially, you know, I think again, for the difference societally anyways, here in the US is that sometimes men don't have other male friends that they can have conversations with and whether they can talk about how they're really feeling. And it can be hard for men out there who don't have those kinds of connections to open up, let alone figure out how to open up and who to open up to. But if, like you're saying, we supply the resource and put it into the discussion that this is available and possible and can be helpful, then more and more people will wake into the idea that they can talk about this. And with a resource like you've provided, I think I don't know if you would call it a roadmap, but it's a good resource, tangible, usable skills.
Exactly.
Tools. Yeah.
Absolutely. We can all be doing this better if we just cognizant of the use of the woman's that they are dominating the field, and being mindful that that's unkind and reflective of what we fought against when the men were excluding us. Mm-hmm. And if you can put that in context of we want to be best for all of us, we can do it. In fact, we can do it right away. It'll be mm-hmm. in the old-fashioned world of the 60s, it was called consciousness raising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think there has been, I don't know if it's like a stereotype of, you know, the kind of not absent father, but the father who's present, but not really helping. And there is a dynamic sometimes that I see for fathers who are trying to be engaged and wanting to be engaged, who kind of never feel like they're doing it right or doing enough, is sometimes they kind of retreat and back out. And then, you know, the female partners get more and more frustrated.
Yep,
exactly. Because it can feel really contentious. And obviously, if the mom or birthing person is a primary caregiver and the father or partner isn't around as much, yeah, they're not going to have as much practice or as much flow into their process. But that doesn't mean they're incapable.
Absolutely. Absolutely right.
Yeah, so it's quite a dynamic to try and you know, help people through, because it can, you know, when people are sleep deprived, it's really hard to be like you know, taking care of each other's feelings when all you want to do is sleep.
Exactly. And it's back to during pregnancy, mm-hmm. ideally before conception. I mean, wouldn't it yeah. be fantastic?
Yes.
And I think I say there's more of that. There's more consciously, let's get pregnant, but let's wait. And then let's, what are we doing? And there's a lot, maybe there's too much thinking that goes into it. Maybe there's not enough spontaneity and just leave things alone. And then, in fact, certainly don't go into this pathological mode. Mm-hmm. Easily, mm-hmm. you know, that tends to be a fallback because that's so sad. We always want to focus on wellness and doing well together and being happy and thrive, and we can and we are. The majority of people do not suffer from illness, and so we, again, if that's the case, we have resources. We need to make sure yeah. that it's available. And the other piece of that is accepting of help.
Right.
That's not easy.
No.
But if you set it up during pregnancy, mm-hmm. Perhaps that can help as couples that need mm-hmm. to look out for each other's needs. But you can't do it alone. There should be extended family and friends around.
Mm-hmm.
Back to, you know, men do have their clubs. They do have their social groups. They do have their groups. There's no reason why they can't start talking about it. They already are, because I know, because I get these calls, and my my husband, because of who we are in our community, there are people who know, isn't your wife, wasn't she involved in PEP? Oh, well, my wife's not doing very well right now.
Yeah.
He will tell, that father tells my husband, who then yeah. tells me. And then I say, well, there's PEP.
yeah, for sure.
You know. And yeah, so we have that in our town. The question is
definitely.
Really quite puzzling to me. Why isn't that the norm in every community? And when I started mm-hmm. PET PSI, my personal mission was to create a postpartum parent support network in every community in the world. So mm-hmm. the key words are parent support
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
community-based, peer-led,
mm-hmm.
voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the norm. It's part of the culture in Santa Barbara because it's been around so dang long. And it doesn't cost anything. And people still come up to me and say, oh, Jane, you saved my life. Well, I didn't save anybody's life. It was the fact mm-hmm. that we had put a system in place.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But as you know, in working in the field and with systems, it takes a little while sometimes, but your persistence and your patience has started many things that have been useful for hundreds of thousands of people now.
It's wonderful.
It's so great.
It's just so gratifying, and it's just mm-hmm. thrilling, and it's so much fun for me to still connect with people. I love it, and yet I don't hear from people anymore. That's one of the things about growing older and mm-hmm. becoming emeritus mm-hmm. and being, not that you're pushed out,
mm-hmm.
But it's right to have a new generation come along. Mm-hmm. It's correct to let go. Your children need to leave the nest. You need to move on, but I'm still alive, and I like to emphasize that I'm still kicking and kind of anxious to see things happen. Applaud everybody who's doing whatever you're doing. I mean, I'm just thrilled.
Right.
I'm just thrilled we've come so far. And we really have achieved mountains of progress.
For sure.
Yeah, and this is like the last remaining thing. I cannot think, except for I will end on this note,
mm-hmm.
That I happen to believe that the word postpartum means forever.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have decided to be a nurturer of somebody else, you care through your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now a grandmother of 8. I'm still postpartum. And
yeah.
people need to understand that means I really care about my family.
Yeah.
It doesn't go away. And it's not negative. And that's the other piece that's so sad for me to think that the word, when we were so proud when we started PEP and used the word postpartum for the first time in the United States, it wasn't about depression.
Right.
No. It was about a time of life. And now at my age, I can say, honey, it's still happening. I still care about how my kids are having. I hope I live to see great grandkids, although
yeah.
some of my granddaughters are not so keen on having children at all. So it's going to be kind of funny to see what happens.
Right.
But that's my point, is that this is long-term. Yeah. This is an intergenerational And we all care about each other. And this is a time in certainly our country's crossroads that we can all gather around and agree on. I don't think we need to be divided whatsoever. And if anybody wants to take issue with me, give me a call. I'd love to have a conversation.
Oh my gosh, I would love to hear that conversation. Yeah, you try and fight this with Jane Honickman. Let's see what happens.
Well, you know, you know that I do have a retreat set up in my home in Santa Barbara, and it's called Postpartum Action Institute, and that's available. Shoshana Bennett and I still do that.
That's fantastic.
And people are welcome to come to Santa Barbara anytime and hang out. It's a
beautiful place to go. So
it's not bad. It's not bad. We can talk people into coming pretty easily.
Absolutely.
So please do that. It's an open invitation, and likewise, I'd love to travel. So I'm waiting for my phone to start ringing and saying, "Oh yeah, why don't you come to us and we'll have a conversation about how we can make it even better."
Oh, fantastic. Thank you, Jane, for all that you do and continue to do, and your passion and compassion is so clear. I hope that, you know, the people who are listening to this can feel that and use some of your energy to take this into their communities as well.
Thanks, Kat. I appreciate you so much, and for all our listeners, for everything people are doing. It's a good time to be alive. That's how I want to end it.
Sure is. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
If you'd like to get connected with Jane, go to @parental_health on both Instagram and Twitter, or look on the website factoringinfathers.com. Thank you all for listening and sharing this podcast with people who can really benefit from this information. And as we keep working, it's imperative that we continue to spread the word and share our stories and involve all parents in the process to parenthood. Thanks so much for being with us. Until next time. Thank you so much for joining us today. Please share this podcast. Together we can support moms and families so that no one has to deal with this alone. Come connect with us at momandmind.com.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play, and we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.